40. The Zeal limousine slid to a stop in front of the Gulfstream G550. Cabrillo climbed out, clutching a folder containing the documents, and made his way up the ramp without hesitating. The co-pilot immediately retracted the ramp and fastened the door. Then he shouted toward the cockpit, "We're good to go!" Instantly, the pilot engaged the igniters, and a few seconds later the jet engines began to spool up. Cabrillo made his way to his seat and fastened the belt as the co-pilot started for the cockpit. "We received your telephone call, sir," the co-pilot said over his shoulder as he slid into his seat. "The course is all plotted, and we've received preliminary clearance." "What's the distance?" Cabrillo asked. "Straight through, it's about 3,400 miles," the co-pilot said. "The winds are favorable, so we estimate 6 hours flight time." The Gulfstream started taxiing toward the runway.
"Easter morning, 7 a.m., Cabrillo said.
"That's the plan, sir," the co-pilot said. Sometimes it all comes down to a few minutes, a few strokes of luck, a few people. At this instant, it was two, Murphy and Gert. Two men, one helicopter with extra fuel pods and a load of explosives, would form the advance team for the liberation of Tibet. They lifted off just after 4 a.m. under the waning light of a quarter moon. Once Gert had the Bell 212 at an altitude of 1,000 feet above ground level, and in a steady forward flight, he spoke into the headset.
"Our mission," he said, "seems fairly impossible."
"Is it the altitude of the pass," Murphy asked, "or the lack of fuel for the return flight that concerns you the most?"
"Neither," Gert said. "It's missing Sunday service and the chicken dinner afterward."
Murphy reached behind his seat and retrieved a small pack. Unzipping it, he removed a single can and a small blue-covered book.
"Spam. And a Bible," he said.
"Excellent," Gert noted. "I can proceed, then."
"Will there be anything else?" Murphy asked.
"Only one more thing," Gert said.
"What's that?"
"Keep your eyes on a road," Gert said. "I don't want to get lost."
"Not to worry," Murphy said. "The Oregon is running the command and control. This operation will run like a well-oiled sewing machine."
"I would have felt better," Gert said, pointing out a herd of deer underneath that were lit by the moon, "had you said like a computer."
Murphy was staring at the instruments.
"We're a little hot," he said. "Take it down a notch."
Gert made the adjustment. They continued north. At about the same instant that the Bell 212 carrying Murphy and Gert crossed into Tibetan airspace, Brikton Gompo was steering the 2.5-ton truck along a rutted dirt road. Locating the spot his Dongkar cell leader had marked, he slowed and pulled to a stop. Gompo was on the flats just below Basatong Wuloshan in an open meadow ringed by stunted trees. Climbing from the truck, he walked around to the rear and removed several metal tubes and felt them. They were cold to the touch. Remembering what he had been told, Gompo pulled a small fuel oil stove from the rear, moved a distance away, then erected the legs. Once the stove was assembled, he removed some tent poles and slid them inside an off-white canvas tent and hoisted the apparatus into the air. Once the tent was secure, he lit the stove, brought the tubes inside to keep them warm, then went back to the rear of the truck and removed a radio, a folding chair, and a fur to cover himself while he waited. Then he switched on the radio and began to listen. Outside the tent, thousands of stars flickered against the black sea of deep space. A cold wind blew down from the mountain. Gompo pulled the fur closer around his neck until the tent warmed. Then he patiently waited for the hours to pass. On the Oregon, Hanley was staring at the wall of flat-screen monitors. Suddenly, the satellite feed of the Russian troop concentration near Novosibirsk began to display a thermal image of tanks being started. At the same instant, the secure telephone began to ring.
"We're a go,"
Cabrillo said.
"I have confirmation over the satellite," Hanley told him. "The Russian tanks are warming."
"Link my computer to the Oregon's databanks,"
Cabrillo ordered.
"I want to monitor the situation from here until I arrive."
Hanley nodded to Stone, who typed in commands on his computer keyboard. "Signal's going out," Stone said a minute later. In the Gulfstream G550, Cabrillo stared at his laptop. Suddenly, the screen erupted with a burst of light, then went dark, then slowly began to glow again. The screen split into six separate blocks, each duplicating what Hanley was seeing.
"I've got it,"
Cabrillo said.
"Mr. Chairman,"
Hanley said. Call the ball.
Proceed as planned,
Cabrillo said.
And link me up with Seng.
You got it, Hanley said. Eddie Seng was pacing back and forth inside the hangar in Thimbu, Bhutan. Occasionally, he would return to the table where the computer screen showed the pulsing red dot that marked the progress of the helicopter carrying Murphy and Gert. Then he would walk around the hangar again, like a caged lion. He answered his telephone before the second ring.
Eddie?
Cabrillo said.
We're a go.
Yes, sir, Seng said. We have a team already flying north. I took the liberty knowing we could call them back if necessary.
Good job,
Cabrillo said.
Max, I'm on the three-way,
Hanley said from the Oregon.
Send Seng the latest data showing the airport near Lhasa. It's being transmitted now.
Seng walked over to the printer. A few seconds later, it began to spit out documents. It's coming across now, Seng noted.
Okay,
Cabrillo said.
You have your playbook and the latest intelligence.
Yes, sir, Seng said.
Now, go take Gongar Airport,
Cabrillo said. You got it, boss, Seng said eagerly. 5 a.m., the early morning hours, when drunks sweat and nightmares grow ugly. A cold wind was blowing across the runway at Gongar Airport, located 59 miles from Lhasa. A pair of Chinese transport planes sat on the far end of the runway along with three helicopters. The other Chinese aircraft inside Tibet had been called north in support of the tank column. Gongar Airport was as deserted as a cemetery on a weekday. A single janitor swept the chipped concrete floor in the crude main terminal. Taking a break to smoke a hand-rolled cigarette, he stepped outside and stood where a wall shielded him from the wind. The limited troops on duty at the airport were sleeping. They were not due to rise for another hour. A sound came up the alley. It was a whoosh, like a well-thrown football. Then a stark, white-colored craft raced past at 30 feet above the tarmac. The strange object sped to the end of the airport, then made an arcing turn and lined up for a pass. Suddenly, twin streams of fire erupted from the sides, and a pair of missiles streaked toward the parked transport planes. The predator had found her prey. In the hangar in Bhutan, Lincoln stared at the image from the predator's onboard cameras. Steering the predator into another arcing turn, he lined up in front of the helicopters and flicked the trigger. Then he made another turn to see the results. The cargo planes were ablaze. The helicopters would join them in a second. At the same instant, 160 yards from the edge of the field, nearly 100 Dungar troops slid out from under white tarps that blended with the snow on the ground. Screaming a war cry, they raced toward the terminal. Dressed in black robes with ceremonial knives in their belts and handguns and rifles that had been smuggled into the country only days before, they swarmed like locusts into predetermined positions. From the south came the thumping sound of seven helicopters approaching. As the helicopter carrying Seng popped up to the plateau, he could see the fires from the predator's attack burning bright in the early morning. Then, as if a divine light was making its way to Earth, a series of red light sticks began to flicker on the tarmac. The Dungar were sending the message it was safe to land. "Land inside the box," Seng said to the pilot. "Will do," the pilot said, starting his descent. Seconds after the helicopter landed, Seng climbed from the front while King made his way from the rear. Seng quickly walked to the terminal where he met up with the leader of the Dungar. At the same time, King motioned to the troops for help and then began to unload crates of rifles and ammunition from the cargo area. "What have you got?" Seng asked the man, who was no more than 30. "The hangar's over there," the man said, pointing. "Contain one fighter plane, one cargo plane, and a pair of attack helicopters. The hangar next door must be for repairs. There's a helicopter disassembled and the fuselage of an observation plane with the engine removed." Cabrillo had asked the Dalai Lama to make sure the Dungar officers he picked were able to speak English. There was no time for his team to learn Tibetan and less time for misunderstanding. "Where did you go to school?" Seng asked. "Arizona State, sir," the man said eagerly. "Go Sun Devils!" "Good," Seng said. "I'm sure you're glad to be home. Now, let's see if we can keep it that way. First, I want a couple of your men to work with the guy coming in on that helicopter." He pointed to another bell just touching down, 20 yards away. "We need to rig these buildings with charges to burn them if necessary." "I'll put a dozen of my best men on it," the man said eagerly. "How many Chinese have you captured?" Tsang asked.
"Less than a dozen, sir," the man said. "One of mine dead, two of theirs."
The airport was a bedlam of activity. The fires burned at the far end of the field against the tapestry of the early morning, and the sound of the landing helicopters added a surreal element to the quiet air. All at once, solitude had become a salvo.
"Listen carefully," Tsang said to the leader of the Dunkar forces. "This comes from the Dalai Lama himself. There will be no brutality or mistreatment of the prisoners. Make sure your men know this clearly. Once this is all said and done, we're returning whatever prisoners we capture to China. My company doesn't want to hear of any atrocities whatsoever. This is a coup d'etat, not an ethnic cleansing. Are we clear on that?"
"Company, sir?" the man asked. "Aren't you United States troops?"
"We're from the States," Tsang said, "at least most of us. But we are a private firm now working under the direction of your leader. If you and the other Dunkar do what we order, in the next 24 to 48 hours there will be a free Tibet once again."
"You done this sort of thing before?" the man asked in amazement.
"There's no time for chit-chat," Tsang snapped. "You all do exactly what you're ordered, and this will go as smoothly as possible."
"Yes, sir."
"Good," Tsang said. "Bring the highest-ranking prisoner to the main terminal and have him seated in a chair and guarded. We'll be setting up operations there in the next several minutes. Then I want to speak to him."
The man shouted orders in Tibetan. The Dunkar soldiers lined up in rows. He explained what Tsang had relayed, then ordered six sergeants to the forefront. Then one group led by a sergeant went off to round up the prisoners. Another split off to the helicopter Kasim had left.
"Holly!" Tsang shouted. "Take these men and wire the other hangars to blow if we need to."
Kasim motioned to the troops and raced back to the helicopter. The bell that had carried Tsang and King to the airfield was now unloaded. King motioned for it to lift off. The pilot descended to 1,000 feet over the field, then began to fly in large, lazy circles. Two more touched down, and Crabtree and Gannon climbed out.
"What's your name?" Tsang shouted to the leader of the Dunkar.
"Rempochi! Pachi Rempochi!"
Gannon and Crabtree raced over.
"Carl," Tsang said, "this is General Rempochi. Tell him what you need."
Gannon walked a few feet away to where they could hear better and explained. Rempochi summoned a sergeant and a dozen men raced off.
"I need the supplies unloaded and taken inside," Crabtree said to Tsang, who pointed to Rempochi.
"General Rempochi," he said, motioning to the man, "we'll take care of it."
Tsang unclipped a portable radio from his belt and switched it on, then spoke.
"Airport is under our control," he said to Hanley on the Oregon. "What do you see?"
Hanley studied the satellite image on the screen before answering.
"No troop movement yet, but if they do come, it will be from the road that enters from the east. There is what looks like a bridge about 3/4 of a mile toward Lhasa. Control that and you'll be able to make a stand if necessary."
"No planes or helicopter activity?" Tsang asked.
"None,"
Hanley said.
"Anything not on the ground there is far to the north. Even if they call them back now, you have an hour or so."
"Good," Tsang said as Meadows walked up. "Reach me by portable if the situation changes."
"We're on full alert,"
Hanley said.
"It all comes down to the next few hours."
Tsang clipped the radio back on his belt and turned to Meadows.
"Bob, take 50 troops and your weaponry down that road," he said, pointing. "There's a bridge we need to control."
"Who's in charge from their side?" Meadows asked.
"General Rempochi," Tsang said, pointing to the man.
At that instant, three trucks slowly drove in front of the terminal and were motioned to stop by Gannon. At the same time, Tom Rise walked over.
"General?"
Tsang shouted. Rempochi approached.
"Yes?"
"I need four of your best men, crack shots and fearless."
Rempochi turned and shouted out names to the cluster of troops. Four men emerged from the crowd. Not one of them was over 5'6". Dripping wet, not one of them could have weighed over 150 pounds.
"Do any of them speak English?" Tsang asked.
"All of them do a little," Rempochi said.
"Tell them this," Tsang said. "They will be going into Lhasa with two of my men to capture a very important man. They need to do exactly what my men tell them, without hesitation."
Rempochi translated. As soon as he had finished, the four men shouted,
"Ha!"
and stomped one foot on the tarmac.
"You have your file?"
Tsang asked Rise.
"Yes, sir," Rise said.
King was a short distance away, removing a long black case from a crate.
"Okay, Larry," Seng shouted. "You and Tom can do your thing."
Holding a set of night vision goggles, King walked over.
"Let's do it," he said.
Rise motioned to the four Tibetans who were eagerly waiting. "We're going to grab someone, and we're going to do it with a minimum of shooting. Do you men understand?"
"I speak fair English," one of the soldiers said. "I'll translate."
He reiterated what Rise had said, then turned.
"Which helicopter?"
"This way," Rise said, leading them back to the helicopter he'd just climbed off. King followed the four Tibetans, and once they were seated inside, the helicopter lifted off and headed into the center of town.
"Who are they after?" Rinpoche asked.
"The chairman of the Tibet Autonomous Region, Legchog Zurin." The last helicopter was on the ground, and Huxley walked over.
"This is our medical officer," Seng said to Rinpoche. "Poll your troops and see if any of your men have any experience as doctors or nurses. If so, we need them to work with Julia here. Right now, however, we need that helicopter unloaded and the contents carried inside the terminal. Miss Huxley will be setting up a field hospital immediately. If any of your men were injured or wounded, she'll treat them shortly."
Rinpoche shouted orders, and men raced to the helicopter to unload. Adams and Gunderson were standing to the side, waiting for Seng to finish. He turned and smiled.
"You two go see what the Chinese have that we can use," Seng said. "I need to interrogate a prisoner."
The two pilots ambled off toward the hangars. Seng walked inside to where a Chinese Air Force lieutenant was sitting in a chair in the middle of the terminal with four fierce-looking Tibetan soldiers surrounding him.